things that you do.
Say what you like about Coldplay, and I was playing Clocks yesterday because it's the 20th anniversary of Rush of Blood going to the head, believe it or not, going to number one. But that's a belter of an album and a belter of the track, and it still makes you jig around a little bit, which my next guest was doing off air. Simon Williams was the man who was kind of responsible for putting Coldplay amongst many others on the map. He was a one-time NME journalist, so I already like him, a former XFM radio presenter, so he knows what it's like to sit in the chair. But he's also the founder of the British indie record label Fierce Panda. He's been at the cutting edge of all things indie for 30 years, including discovering bands such as Coldplay, Keane, Placebo, and countless others, some of whom have filled stadium and gone worldwide, and some of whom can't fill a pub sometimes on a wet Wednesday. And he's done it all. He's lived to tell the tale. There is a hard edge to this story as well, which he's going to tell us all about. The author of Pandemonium, How Not to Run a Record Label, Simon Williams. Simon, delighted to have you with us on the show today. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Isn't it good? I mean, Parachutes was such a great album. And I remember when it first came out at that time. What was it, 98, 99?
I think it was 2000 by the time the actual album came out. When we worked with them, they hadn't even written Yellow at that point. That appeared about a year after we did the first single with them. So it was quite a slow process, to be honest with you. And I think there were rumours about, was there a scrapped album? I know they tried to sack their drummer at one point and then they had to get him back in, which they were quite apologetic about. But yeah, no, it was just a breath of fresh air around that time. It really was. And I think the thing about when Yellow, it kind of got to number four in the charts, and even their own record company was completely bewildered. You know, they just hit that absolute sweet spot.
Yeah, and there were bands like, you know, Travis were not going around. It was a particular sound, wasn't it, at that time, because we were kind of coming to the end of the bluster, if you like, of the in-your-face, sort of full-on, sort of Cool Britannia stage, and Blur and Oasis had sort of slugged each other out, hadn't they? Yeah. So we needed some reflection. You were...
Yeah, 1999 is generally seen as one of the worst years ever for music, which maybe on the surface it was. If you were looking at the cover of the NME, you had bands like Campag Velocet and Gay Dad fighting.
Blimey. Yeah. Yes, indeed. I forgot about that. I mean,
but our grassroots level, you know, that's where that sort of 98, 99, that's when Elbow, Coldplay, Snow Patrol, Doves, Keane, they all did their first, you know, first proper shows and got their first little record deal. So it was an incredibly brilliant time. And what they were all bands that obviously hadn't been sitting there listening to Oasis. They'd been like listening to Radiohead and trying to work out how Johnny Greenwood got those guitar sounds. So that it just took them a bit longer to actually work out how to get their sound and therefore break through.
And also the thing is, this is pre-internet, before it takes off on smartphones. So, and it's before X Factor, I think, or before all those talent shows that throw people unprepared into the marketplace. So they had to play gigs together. They had to learn their craft. They had to be good live. And so it's not a case of, I put a single out on YouTube and suddenly I'm shifting lots of downloads, because there were still albums or CDs at that time. And so therefore, in 1998 or 1999, these bands, you know, were still just coming to the boil, as it were.
Yeah, and also, pretty much all of them had been rejected by major labels. They all had to really, really struggle and do independent singles. I think Elbow had to release their own single on their own label because nobody cared. The only reason why we ended up with Coldplay was the fact that every single major label had passed on them. They just thought that, you know, they thought that Chris Martin looked like an idiot and the songs were rubbish. And then we did a single that got onto Radio One, and then everyone changed their minds.
Mm. You did that. I mean, and you know, if you're a younger listener, I mean, ask your parents. But you did that sort of that classic thing, because people forget. And I keep banging on this because I'm, you know, mid-50s now, blimey O'Reilly, but NME, new music, you know, NME, Sounds, Melody Maker, I mean, we waited for these to come out, and this is pre-internet, you know, I was down there, you know, buying CDs, buying vinyl, you know, every Saturday, and people forget, you know, the huge influence that the NME had on breaking bands or getting bands out there.
Yeah, and it was... And it was pretty genuine, really. I mean, in the end, it was weird running Fierce Panda when I worked at the NME, because there was a little bit, dubious, to be honest with you. And it was great doing the book, just looking back and going, how corrupt was I? But the weird thing is that the NME was fundamentally a commercial newspaper, so it had to write what was happening. And when Fierce Panda was, you know, at its peak in around sort of 95, 96, most of the bands were terrible that the NME was writing about. You know, the good Britpop bands had come through. We'd already done Ash and Supergrass and bands like that. You know, come 96 and 97, it was just, the bands were awful, but they were all getting in the charts. So the NME had to write about them to appease the listeners. It was a very weird time.
Yeah, and why did you decide to, was there a sort of a bright shining light from the indie gods above saying, you down there, you know, Williams, go forth and fight, you know, because the indie bands have been around for a while. You know, indie bands aren't, you can go back to the Cocteau Twins and The Cure and all that stuff, you know, and Stiff and whatever else from the 70s and the 80s. So what on earth possessed you to put these guys out and form, and how difficult was it to form your own?
Well, I think a lot of people, they kind of, it wasn't so much a bright light as a kind of dull light bulb in the corner of the blue posts on Tottenham Court Road. And that's where, that was one of our offices. And we'd created this scene called New Wave of New Wave. And we just decided that it needed a tribute record. That was it, simple as that. And that was why it was called Fierce Panda, because we were just going to release one record and then leave it. You know, if I thought we'd still be here 28 years later, I might have put a bit more thought into it and come up with something a bit more constructive. But you're right, that indie spirit. I'd watched, you know, my local record shop in Walthamstow was Small Wonder, and they did the first singles by, you know, Bauhaus and The Cure and records like that. So that was like 1978. So I grew up with it, and I had that. That became Ugly Child Records. It was, and then, yeah, I went through C86, so all the Primal Screams and Wedding Presents and all those bands, and then, you know, so by the time we started the label, you know, I'd already done a fanzine. I'd been going to gigs for like 10 years. So it wasn't completely a bunch of idiots in the pub not knowing what they were doing, but it was fairly close. But luckily we knew someone who knew how to do all these things. And he was Ian from Damaged Goods Records, which was an indie label from East London, very punk rock, absolutely hated NME journalists. So it was the perfect fit. And we, you know, we'd find the bands, we'd get the DAT cassettes from them. Do you remember those tapes?
Blimey, yes.
Yeah. And then we'd bike them over to his house. And then about 6 weeks later, you'd get all these double vinyl 7-inch singles, and he'd sorted out, you know, manufacturing, marketing, radio, distribution, you know, all those things. We had no idea how any of those things worked. We were just NME idiots, and, you know, the records just appeared like magic.
Because if you're a bunch of NME journalists and decide to form your own band, which we just talked about a bit earlier, you know, then it's quite easy. You just pick up some instruments, make an awful record, and off you go. But there are nuts and bolts to forming a record label, and actually not only just pressing the thing and finding, you know, how do you find, you know, vinyl, but also then distribution, marketing, all these, because, you know, otherwise, you know, you're just sitting there, I was going to say sending copy down the line, but actually probably just actually writing copy back in those days.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And Ian, I mean, Ian was so punk rock that initially we were with a distribution company called SRD, who were based in Tottenham. And he got so fed up with them, he didn't just move distribution. He set up a brand new distribution company around the corner called Shellshock, just so, you know, they could do a better job on his releases. And he was absolutely brilliant to us. Without him, you know, it would have been just another idea that would have stayed in the corner of the blue posts, lost forever.
So how did you go about getting the bands? I mean, obviously, as you're saying, you were out there doing your own A&R. Again, kids, ask your parents. But you were out there as part of the job, I suppose, seeing bands playing all over the place. So you had a pretty good idea. Did you have a good idea which bands had a following, rather than, you know, they were just sending sort of cassettes through to John Peel, and, you know, there were three guys in a barn in Shrewsbury, for example?
Yeah, well, the one thing that I always found was that the bands who tended to have a following, like, you know, in the really, really small venues, they tended to be awful. There was just something about, they were just really, really commercial and crossed over, and they had like really good rich friends. Where the interesting bands, they were the ones who didn't have any following whatsoever. Those were the interesting ones. But they probably had a bit of a buzz, which is a different thing entirely. So the first bands we saw were Smash and These Animal Men. And they were basically these kind of little kids, took a lot of drugs, wore Adidas, And bearing in mind, this is in the wake, you know, we're talking about 1993. So at that point, everyone's wearing Nirvana t-shirts and pretending they're in Pearl Jam. So this was a completely, definitely tiny little thing. I think John Harris, who was one of my colleagues in the label, he's gone on to say that New Wave of New Wave was Britpop without the good bits, which is kind of cruel, but at the same time, you know, fairly true. But within 6 months, everyone in Camden was walking around wearing Adidas. And, you know, the Nirvana t-shirt was buried in the back of the wardrobe. It had an enormous effect. And it developed a whole little generation of, you know, fanzine writers and filmmakers and, you know, labels. Everyone's outlasted the bands, ironically enough. But I guess that's not the first time that's happened in the history of rock and roll. See the Velvet Underground and Joy Division and whatever, you know. But for me, you know, the Fierce Panda would not have existed without it. We wouldn't have had the inspiration to do it.
And it's interesting that you make that comparison, because if you think about it, when everybody was deep in, you know, the Pearl Jam, Nirvana, walking around pretending that they were, you know, wasted and whatever. And I've interviewed people who were over in, you know, working the record business in LA, and the A&R men, again, ask your parents, they just sent legions of people up to Seattle to sign anybody, because they were behind the curve. So you had these guys who were just being, you know, okay, we're 3 miles out, you know, you'll do, you've got the hairstyle. And that perhaps, I'm not saying that you guys were, you know, futurologists, but to kind of spot the little trends that are going on and think, okay, that's different.
Yeah, I mean, that's still the same principle today. There's no point in us trying to go out and find a post-punk band, because there's already, you know, radio DJs still are already confused by all the new bands that are coming through. You know, we were doing post-punk bands before post-punk even existed. We did Desperate Journalists, you know, about 7 years ago. So, you know, what's interesting now is just finding something different. Let's do Ollie Swan, who's doing this kind of 1980s sound, like Thomas Dolby, Prefab Sprout, that kind of thing. But he wants to, he says that makes it sound a bit old, so throw in Tame Impala. And sorry, I've been a bit tied up, because I've been co-writing the new track with Robbie Williams. And you're going, that's interesting. That's what I like. And I also love the local aspect of it, because I live in Suffolk now. And what I really love, what I say to bands is, don't worry about London. It's just overrun with chaos, and it's just weird. The promoters don't know what they're doing. No one knows what's doing anything, what's going on. So, you know, we've got a band from Norwich called Bag of Cans. We've got a band from Belfast called Winona Bleach. We've got a band from Malmo called The Shatterheads. Every single one of them is just, focus on yourselves. You know about your local press and radio more than I do. You know, just crack on with it, and then we'll meet in 6 months in London and pretend that we're glorious.
So what was the moment that you thought, hang on, this is actually, we're actually becoming quite successful here. This is that we're actually having an impact, rather than we're just doing something which is, you know, which is bumbling along quite nicely.
Well, we did, so we did the first EP, and then we decided we'd do another one, completely forgetting about our original intention just to do one record and call it a day. So we did another four EPs, and one of them had Green Day on, and one had Lush, one had the Blue Tones, and one was a load of teenagers with Ash and Supergrass and people like that. So then we got the bug. And then what I thought happened was, then we just found Placebo and off we went. But then when I was writing the book, I was looking through my diaries going, that wasn't the case at all. We actually went completely punk rock and just started doing, like, I don't know, I read a headline in a newspaper saying Susie Quattro lives in Chelmsford. And it's kind of, well, we better do an EP then. So we did an EP and a tour just called Susie Quattro Lives in Chelmsford. And we did these three hardcore bands. We did Scarfo, who were very, very, very agit-pop. And we just went completely punk rock. So in 1995, when Britpop was taking off, we were doing that opposite and walking right away from the whole epicenter of the music industry. It was the best year of our lives, to be honest with you. And then we did Wibbling Rivalry by Oasis.
And right, so explain that, because people seem to think that it's McKee finding them at King Tut's. So what's the timeline on this one, Sardar? For those
who don't know, the timeline is, so this is 95. They're doing they're doing Sound City in Glasgow, which is a little industry. Well, not industry, it's full of, you know, the general public was there as well, and they're just on the cusp of the edge of the precipice of breaking through. So, and people are still a bit dubious about them. It's kind of, well, it's good, but that really is a Coca-Cola song, and that really is T-Rex, and that really is quite status quo-y. I'd been on the road with them on their first tour, and they were doing like Newport TJs and Portsmouth Wedgwood Rooms and Derby Victoria Inn, and it was literally just them. They didn't have a roadie, they didn't have a TM, they didn't have anyone with them, and they were just really nice guys. In fact, the most entertaining were probably sort of Bonehead and Grigsby, yeah. the ones they were the clowns in the band. And then, a few months later, a few weeks later, I was in Scotland, and then John Harris turned up saying, "Right, I'm up here to interview Oasis," and we had this enormous fight. So I said, "We can't interview them again. We've just put them on the front. We can't, you know, there isn't that much to say about them." So we had an argument about doing an interview, which turned out to be the biggest argument in the history of rock and roll. And that's what changed everything, because all of a sudden it was these boys are really, really dangerous, but funny with it. You know, it was the last time they were ever interviewed together in the music press. I think there was one more time they did an interview on the Evening Session where basically everyone just got sacked because the boys just carried on swearing for like an hour. And whereupon they were never interviewed together on the radio again. But it was just, and that's what changed everything. I think that was our 12th release. And if we'd just done another single or another T-shirt, we'd have probably just gone, well, that's what Postcard Records did. They got to 12 and then they stopped, you know, show a bit of elegance, show a bit of like class. But this record, it got to 52 in the charts. And it just took us into strange new areas that we'd never been into before. So, and that's what, then we did Placebo, and then we did Kinnicky, and then we did Three Colours Red, and then we did Embrace, and then I was hooked.
Yeah. I mean, you said just as a throwaway line, you know, I discovered Placebo. you know, because they were just sort of lying there, were they? Because, you know, Placebo, they have cut their own, haven't they? They followed their own path like no other band, I think. And they're massive. I mean, they're huge, and their followers are absolutely fanatical about them.
Yeah. Well, I saw them recently supporting My Chemical Romance in Milton Keynes in the UK.
Of course. I mean, Chemical Romance have nicked the whole set off them, haven't they?
Of course, yeah. But they kind of, I'm sitting there going, oh, there's something missing about this. And I was talking to the manager afterwards, said, was it my imagination or did they not play any of their early hits? And he went, no, they didn't. The general vibe is, I think Brian's vibe is, we're not the Charlatans. So it's kind of, you know, we've got a new album and we're playing that. And it's kind of, that's why they're still big, I guess. It's kind of, they've got that kind of, you know, sort of angry streak about them that sort of drives them on. But yeah, so I think I'd met a live agent, Steve Strange, who ended up actually doing Coldplay and Eminem. And he just said, you know, this is how the music industry worked in the 90s. You'd be, before the internet and mobile phones, you'd be standing outside the Dublin Castle having a pint. And the Irishman would go, oh, I've just seen this incredible band called Placebo. They played their third ever gig last night supporting the Catherine Wheel at the Underworld. And he'd go, all right, then. So we put on their fourth gig and then we signed them. And that's how it worked back then. You know, there was no like, you know, oh, send me a demo, boys. It's kind of, well, he says that you're brilliant, so I'm just going to put you on. You know, let's not waste time here.
Yeah.
And it was very, very instinctive and very innocent and you know, it's a bit stupid.
Well, no, because it's that post-punk thing. And it's always, and I love the we've had several Camden references already, Dublin Castle. Yes, indeedy. But it was that, you know, this is the pre-polished internet age. So, you know, it is a case of, right, grab them, get it out, see what, you know, throw it at the wall and see what sticks. And that was kind of what happened with Pandemonium. And also, this is pre people taking selfies and people downloading videos. And, you know, there's a fair bit of interesting behavior going along in Camden at that particular, and all through London at that particular time. So, you know, it was a lifestyle.
It was definitely a lifestyle, and everything that you've ever read about Britpop is completely true. And it ended up in some very, very nasty places for nasty people, especially when it came to very, very hard drugs. You know, you had to be very careful. And luckily, you know, I think because of our indie spirit, with whether it be The Enemy or Fierce Panda or even XFM, I think, you know, we generally managed to bypass most of it just because we were just drunk and having like a really, really nice time. You know, we weren't part of that career trail where the second album brought us down. You know, we managed to sort of skirt past all of that. And mainly because, you know, we were just churning out all these one-off singles and we were always there for the good times. You know, so with Placebo or Embrace, you were there for their first ever reviews, their first ever radio play, their first ever significant gigs. And the bands, that's when the bands are happy. It's only like, you know, 18 months down the line when they've started to get bitter and twisted and cynical that they get upset, by which point that's someone else's responsibility. No, mostly Hot Records, judging by the amount of bands that moved on from us to them.
Yeah, but I suppose it is because it's that joyful thing, isn't it? And because you start, you know, a couple of guys in a garage or in a bedroom and suddenly you're signed to a record label and you've got a chart. I mean, wasn't it Chris Martin being unbelievably happy because he was at number 59 on the charts or something?
Oh, no, 59 would have blown his head off. He would, number 92 is what made him happy. Yeah, he was completely delighted. But he was, and again, it, what's interesting is that they were part of that whole scene, you know, because you know, all right, the Britpop thing might have started dying in Camden, but it was still where you had to play, and they lived in Camden, and that was back when, you know, the agents and managers weren't so precious about, you know, the career path, a bit more casual about it. So bands like Coldplay could play the Laurel Tree once or twice, the Bullen Gate twice. You know, they're allowed to build up a little fan base and just get going. Whereas now, you know, once you're worth more than 100 punters, then you've got a team behind you just propelling you upwards through the music industry, which is a bit sad.
So, you know, how have you kept your sanity? Because, you know, there was a period of time, shall we say, that you know, you hit a wall.
Yeah.
And B, kept your love for music, because the industry is littered with sort of, you know, with the bodies of bitter and twisted people who go, well, and people go, I mean, we're getting loads of, you know, 30 years since Definitely Maybe, and you know, we'll have a whole thing about, you know, the Oasis, Blur are getting back together again, and we're getting that Britpop nostalgia, heaven help us, and Suede, I think, you know, so are we, you know, how did you keep the enthusiasm, and you don't go back to that sort of retro, things were better back then sort of feel to it?
Well, they were better back then, to be fair. I mean, the one thing I realized,
we were younger, so we could survive it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the main thing for me is that I just really like going to gigs. That's the fundamental thing. I started going to gigs in 1982, and I thought this was absolutely brilliant. And I was only 16 years old, and then, you know, and then I just started liking promoting gigs, and then I suddenly realized I'm running a record company just so I can put on gigs. That's the key element to it, and. You know, and it's the most profound, important thing in the music industry. And I always find it bewildering when it's now, you know, the A&R system is just streaming. It's kind of, it's just people looking at their laptops, working out who's got a billion SoundCloud listens or whatever. And then they'll just, you know, they could be a 17-year-old kid in Glasgow that may have never played live before, but here's £1 million. You know, that whole, it used to be a lot more fun. It used to be a lot more warmer. There used to be a career path, a very clear career path for bands. And by no means, by any stretch of the imagination, is Fierce Panda the only indie label doing this. But, you know, look at the amount of bands that moved on from Creation. Look at the amount of bands that moved on from Mute or any other indie label. You know, that was just the system. And everyone's quite happy with it, you know. And then one day in the noughties, the major labels just suddenly thought, we can make money off this. And all of a sudden they were doing the Kooks and Kasabian and all those bands, and they didn't need indie labels anymore. And that's what changed the whole parameters. And ever since then, there's been a decline into the level of, you know, I see some major label bands and they're ostensibly guitar bands, and I'm watching them for half an hour on stage at Latitude in front of 20,000 people. And within 3 minutes, I'm at the bar and I can't remember a single thing about the band. I can't remember what they look like. I can't remember what they sound like. I can barely remember their name. And you just think this is, and kids are watching this going, is this what guitar music's all about? And it's not. It's just been so homogenized by the major label system that it's kind of, you know, people think guitars are dying. And if you're on that level, it is. It's awful. But on our level, there's just so much going on.
But, I mean, it is like that situation. I go back to Camden because, you know, bands were playing all over the place. So bands were interacting with each other. So they, you know, you went to Camden, you played, you know, a lot of them weren't very good, but at least you could see somebody. I think, oh, okay, I'll nick that riff, or I like that bit and the whole thing. And they kind of grew up together. Whereas now they're just being dropped in to do a Latitude. I will put them on, you know, at 3 o'clock and see how they fare. And because they haven't done the hired yards.
Yeah. But we've also got the fact that the industry is kind of, you know, it's quite facile, isn't it? So there's this industry magazine called Music Week. And it's just basically, it's just great news. It might just be called Great News Mag. And it's brilliant. You know, it keeps me in touch with everything that's going on. But I'd love to do a column just called Music Week, like Flimsy, like Broken, and just say who's been dropped this week. And just list those bands that, you know, because you always hear about the signing and you see the picture with the bottles of champagne, but you never see the picture of the band being like, you know, removed from the building when the first album's bomb. It's a bit like that. And it's the same with books. You know, you look at books. I used to go to Waterstones and look at the history of the Stone Roses or Green Day, and I'd look through the index and see if my name was in there. And if it wasn't, I'd just walk out again because I'd think, well, it's not the true story. And I think we're getting to the point now that there seems to be a lot of. I was talking to my publisher about one of the Britpop bands who were very, very young at the time, And the duty of care around the band was just absolutely non-existent. They were completely, you know, their signing meal was at the Ivy restaurant. Mm. And they're 16-year-old kids who's the highlight of their culinary career being going to like Mackie D's on Stockton Court Road. They're just thrown into it. And even there are people, there are people from the record company saying, this is just stupid. Why don't we just take them down, you know, down to Burger King? But, you know, the music industry is just so set in its ways and it has to try and impress people. And I think what's happening now is that those stories are finally coming out. It's not just, you know, band signs major deal and then sells loads of records. The true stories are starting to come out. And that's why I feel comfortable enough to do the Fierce Panda book. And, you know, Mickey from Lush has got a book coming out where, you know, she's similarly, you know, heartfelt about her upbringing and what goes on behind the scenes. And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to inspire people in a kind of, look, it might look brilliant, but it's really, really tough. But that doesn't mean that's a bad thing. You know, here are the things I've been through. Here's the thing that Mickey's been through, but we're still doing it. We've still found a way of doing it. And we're still going to try and help you to, you know, become what you need to be, which sounds a bit naff, but yeah. I think, but you know, there's a clear reason why these books, it's not self-indulgence. It's not, I need to pour my heart out and whine and moan. I couldn't have done this book 3 years ago. I was too angry. I was too bitter. I really hated the music industry. I hated everything it stood for. I despised bands. I hated myself. You know, just the classic cliche, just watching the music industry die. And nothing much has really changed over the past 3 years, but COVID's just given me a bit of a restart. So basically, the situation, I was in hospital for 2 weeks and I came out of hospital and they said, well, you know, not sure about you going to gigs for quite a long time. And I thought, okay, well, I'll have to deal with it. And then like 3 weeks later, this thing called a pandemic happened.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, no one was going to gigs. And I thought, blimey, that was a good dream, wasn't it? How the managed that I twist that one to my own end? There was I had no FOMO because there was no Mo.
There was Mo going on. Exactly. I mean, everybody was sending files to each other and, I was interviewing drummers sitting their drum kits and going, you know, we just want to get out. We just want to get out there.
I know. And again, and then you get that empathy through because obviously, you know, I think we managed to do a newsletter every month. And we had a core of bands who were managed to carry on because Desperate Journalists were two couples. China Bears, we've got a pair of twins. Mm. Moon Panda are a couple. So they could be isolated together and still create. But the bands who, if you had five different band members all living in different parts of London, then they couldn't do anything for, you know, 18 months. Their lives and their careers were on hold. Mm. We can do what we can do. We can be mid 50s and carry on. Because we're not singers in a band, or we're not, at least we're not Bono or Rod Stewart. But if you're 27, 28, your career is literally running down that very, very quiet street outside.
Yeah, and unless you get invited out to the Dave Grohl sort of single, you nobody's going to hear your music, are they?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Just I want to pick on this one word, and I know we haven't got long, but, you know, duty of care, because we went through that period, that horrendous period where, you know, these kids, and they've always got a backstory about, you know, their mother was, you know, was eaten by a giant caterpillar or something, and they're doing this song, and they you know, they whack out a Whitney song, and they hit so many octaves that air traffic is diverted around Hounslow. You know, it's always the bleeding same. Yeah, I'm not a fan, in case you haven't gathered. And then they get signed to a label and then they're gone and there is no backup on this because they haven't done gigs before and they think that their life is now going to be one long Ivy champagne and people buying their records. And that has a huge impact on mental health for young people. I think it's something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I did the audiobook and the producer was saying that one of her friends has just... Again, just a little TikTok track and 17 years old. And they're saying, right, okay, so you're going to play some gigs. Here's your band. And away you go. And it's kind of like, okay, what's a gig? You know, it's just these people got no experience. And you can just see that. And as you say, if they don't impact within 6 months, if that TikTok track doesn't succeed, then they're dropped out. I think I was being told yesterday there was someone had a 15-second bit of music that had blown up on TikTok. And she worked in a coffee shop. And all the A&R people had found where the coffee shop was. So they're all sitting there on different tables waiting for her to finish serving muffins so they could actually sign a deal whereby they could actually write the other 2.5 minutes to go with the 15 seconds they had of this song, and, you know, and give her £1 million. And you're thinking, that's not like the old days.
Yes, but on the flip side, there are still guys and girls getting together and writing musics with real instruments, which has got to be. And so we're all for the return of vinyl and live music and live gigs, which obviously you're looking forward to as well. As you can gather, I could have talked to you about this until probably about Saturday, but I'm going to run out of bleeding time. So if you want to hear more about this, go and buy the book. The book is called Pandemodium, How Not to Run a Record Label. You're still doing quite well, all things considered. It's by Simon Williams. Simon, if people want to track you or Fierce Panda down and find out what's stirring in Suffolk or what's, you know, I don't know, other parts of the country, where can they find you on online if you're not chasing TikTok people around?
I'm just going for Keep It Old School, fiercepanda.co.uk. That's where everything is.
Brilliant. Well, listen, it's been great to speak to you. The book is called Pandemonium. It's by Simon Williams. Simon, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.